It's been a long time since passengers rode the rails between the Chippewa Valley and the Twin Cities, but there's a concerted effort now to, and has been for some time, to bring passenger train service back to our region. For 16 years, a regional group has been working to raise awareness of and interest in connecting our region with the Minneapolis Metro once again. Today we'll talk with some of the forces behind this effort about why they say now is the time to get on the train. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. We've got three guests in the studio with me today, all hyped up and jazzed about trains. First, I'd like to introduce Scott Rogers. He is the chair of the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition. He's also government affairs director for the Eau Claire Area Chamber of Commerce. Scott Rogers, welcome to the West Side.
Rich, thanks for having us.
Our pleasure. Next, I'd like to introduce Dave Christensen. He's the former rail project manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. We'll explain why we've got a Minnesotan in the studio in just a bit, but welcome, Dave Christensen.
Thank you, Rich.
And we've also got Nick Amundson. He is the director of research for Jamf Software here in Eau Claire, making a lot of waves. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Rich.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. Would you like to see passenger rail service between Eau Claire, Greater Chippewa Valley, to the Twin Cities? What do you think about passenger rail to Chicago? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. And if you're old enough to remember riding the old 400 line, please give us a call. I'd love to hear some stories about that. 1-800-228-5615. Scott Rogers, I'll start with you. I already alluded to it, and I'm a spoiler here, but when was the last time that there was a passenger train that moved between here and the Twin Cities?
Well, there are probably rail buffs that could give you the exact date, but it was July of 1963 when the last Twin Cities 400 stopped in each direction in Eau Claire, Menominee, and Hudson.
Okay, so what did that look like? I mean, we're talking back in the 60s. The 400, what did that stand for, and how many trips? How did it work?
If you look back in the history of railroads, there were three very competitive railroads between Chicago and the Twin Cities, which is still one of the largest travel markets in the country, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the Burlington that went up the river. Another one was they had their Zephyrs. You had the Milwaukee Road that went through La Crosse and Milwaukee. They had the Hiawathas. And then the Northwestern, the Chicago and Northwestern, which was the predecessor railroad of what's now the Union Pacific, they started a fast passenger train between Chicago, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. They called it the 400. And the idea was it went 400 miles in 400 minutes, which was pretty fast then. Sometimes it got up to 100 miles an hour.
Mm.
And then I think in the terminology of the day, the 400 was kind of a connotation for the upper crust or the society set. And so it sort of had a double meaning. And it ran once a day and started out as a steam engine in the 30s. In the around the 40s, they converted to diesels, and it was a yellow passenger train that a lot of people can remember riding. They had other trains. They named a lot of their other trains between other cities different variations of the 400, like the Green Bay 400 and the Flambeau 400. But the Twin Cities 400 was the one that stopped here, and it only actually ran once a day, even though they had some other trains.
Once a day, okay. And of those handfuls that you mentioned, we've got the, I recognize the Hiawatha line. That's still in service between Milwaukee and Chicago, correct?
What happened was in 1971, Amtrak, which is a sort of government agency, sort of private corporation, because the railroads were in the process of getting out of the passenger train business, basically from the late 50s into the early 70s. Congress looked at that, said, we need passenger trains. We need to do something about it. They started Amtrak. Amtrak at that time took over a number of lines in the country. They cut in about half the number of trains that were operating at the time, but all the routes that they picked up were in operation then. And so the Hiawatha line through La Crosse was one of the last ones still running, and that's what the line they chose for Chicago to Twin Cities. This train had already been discontinued 8 years earlier, so we weren't even considered for service at that time.
A reminder to our listeners, we're talking about passenger rail service, a big push to bring it passenger rail service between Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley to the Twin Cities along a route right along 94, I believe, Interstate 94. We'll talk about that more in a bit. Right now we're kind of laying down the history of what was available to people who wanted to go to the Twin Cities and not drive. 800-228-5615. We can get you on the air to ask a question or give us a story if you've got any memories. So a couple things I want to bring up here. Dave Christensen, it sounded like high-speed rail, you know, existed in a way, in a form, before, you know, nowadays. It seems like a new trendy catchphrase.
Yeah, Rich, back in the days. Back in the days, the Hiawatha and the Zephyr and the 400 all operated at 100 miles per hour or faster on certain stretches of track.
Hmm.
The high-speed rail that everybody remembers seeing in newspapers probably about 5 to 10 years ago that was being considered between Chicago and Twin Cities, and Eau Claire was one of the three possible routes that were being considered for that. It was 110-mile-per-hour service. That is still in the planning process to go up the river on the Minnesota side from La Crosse through Red Ring and Winona. But we're also considering in the future looking at true high-speed rail, like what the rest of the world has, 185 to 220 miles per hour. That would need a new right-of-way between Chicago and Twin Cities. Eau Claire would be a perfect route because of our geography.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow travel from the Twin Cities to Chicago in 2 to 3 hours maximum. Any travel in an intermediate corridor less than 3 hours is proven to be competitive with airlines and car, especially car travel. And that's something that we see for the farther future. What we're looking at right now is because this is such a strong travel corridor and the Chippewa Valley area is such a strong economic presence in the upper Midwest that we definitely see a viable and possibly profitable operation to put private passenger rail service back onto the existing rail lines between here and the Twin Cities.
Possibly profitable. That's an interesting term. We'll get back to the funding mechanisms and what it'll take to get these tracks up to par to be able to have faster trains on them. But why did it drop off in the first place, Scott Rogers? What happened?
It's a very complex issue, but from the 30s, particularly into the 50s and 60s, we had tremendous public investment going to other modes of transportation, particularly highways and airports. And we effectively paid people to drive or paid people to fly because of the amount of public investment that went in. And it wasn't really only that. The railroads primarily had freight service. That was where they made their money. And they were heavily regulated. And it was really hard for them on the economics of passenger trains. So even though the thought is that people just didn't want to take trains anymore, trains still probably had a place in the marketplace, but the economics weren't working for the railroads. They started to actively get out of the service. But the service was so strong, or the need was so strong in some parts of the country, that we found ways to keep it running. And so what we're finding now is with some changes in society and demographics, the advantages of land use and being able to have this sort of missing link in transportation come back, we're sort of have this back to the future trend going on. And if you look around the country, we're starting to see passenger trains develop, and there are lots of people in the U.S. riding trains these days.
800-228-5615 is the number to call. We're talking about passenger rail and a big push to bring it back to the Chippewa Valley. 800-228-5615. So tell me, Scott Rogers, a little bit about the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition. When did it form? How long have you been plugging away at this thing?
Well, back in the 1990s, the state of Wisconsin, under some of our previous administrations, the Thompson, McCallum, and Doyle administrations, was actually a leader in the Midwest, saying we should have a network of trains between some of our major cities. And some of the leaders here from the Chippewa Valley, names that some of the listeners might recognize, like Owen Ayers, who founded Ayers Associates, Bill Leinenkugel from Leinenkugel Brewing, Ray Willoughby, who's still active with us, who was a bank president at the time, Bill Eilenfeldt, the CVTC president at the time. They saw that the state was developing this network or talking about a network, and Eau Claire, the West Central Wisconsin, Hudson, Menominee were not on the map. They were planning service to Green Bay and the Fox Cities, to La Crosse, to Madison, and they said, you know, we have a major population area here that's a growing part of the state. Should we be considered? And so the impetus of the coalition was to say, let's go to Wisconsin DOT, go to the state government. If they're planning a rail system in the future, we need to be considered for that. And so they did. They were successful in getting some studies done that indicated that if service were operated through Eau Claire, in addition to service through La Crosse and the Chicago Twin Cities corridor, that it would be economically feasible and additive. And so the initial effort of the coalition, when it was under the purview of state government promoting passenger rail service, was to get our area included in the long-term planning, which is actually something that's come to fruition just within the last 2 to 3 years.
Right. But those were long-range plans still. At the time, were they, what, 20 years or 30 years or anything like that?
Well, it actually, there was some foresight there. If you look back, it predated some of the growth that did happen in passenger rail service. And one thing that listeners may not know is that the Chicago to Milwaukee corridor has 7 trains a day. The state of Wisconsin's very involved in the planning that and working on improvements to it. It's had its ridership grow substantially over the last 10 years. And in fact, it's the highest traveled Midwest corridor of passenger rail service. And so the state's been involved in that, and people may not be aware of that. But some of the strength of the rail passenger service and the ridership growth hadn't been happening yet in the 90s. It's been more of a phenomenon here now in the 2000s and into the early 20-teens. I don't know if that's a term. And so we had some advanced planning going on, and we've seen some benefits from it, but the state has kind of backed off on that. And I might be segueing too soon, but we don't necessarily see, Dave Christensen had mentioned private passenger service. We don't necessarily see getting Amtrak to operate this is the way to go.
Right.
And so when we come back to that, we're going to look at some other ways, and that's really what moves us to where we are and even why reasons that Nick Amundsen's here from JAMF.
Sure. I want to go to Dave Christensen and explain why, you know, to have him explain why we've got someone from Minnesota DOT in Eau Claire talking about passenger rail service in Wisconsin. So, Dave, tell us about the Minnesota rail plan and what it is.
Yeah, I have to admit first that I am born in Wisconsin, in Bloomer, Wisconsin, and I'm a Packer.
God bless you. God bless you.
But I was a project manager for the Minnesota State Rail Plan in 2010 and then again in 2015. One of the things we looked at in Minnesota is that with 3 million people in Twin Cities and places like Madison, Milwaukee, and Chicago just within a reasonable travel distance, that we had a good place for passenger rail service to be developed. In our state rail plan, we looked at 5 different corridors, one of them being Eau Claire. Eau Claire is as much a regional center for the Twin Cities as Duluth Superior or St. Cloud or Rochester. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's the strongest regional center that feeds into the Twin Cities. And so we looked at feeder corridors that would help support the Twin Cities to Chicago core line that we expect to make money anywhere from 40 to 100% payback on out-of-pocket costs of daily operations. So all that looked at developing what amounts to very substantial multiple trips a day travel on each of the corridors, anywhere from true high-speed travel between Rochester and Twin Cities to conventional travel up to 79 miles per hour between places like Eau Claire and the Twin Cities. Most people don't know it, but there are 18 states and 25 services around the country that are not run by Amtrak but by the states and local interests. Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Missouri all have state trains.
Hmm.
And they're all very well utilized, except possibly for Indiana. And they just went through the process of privatizing their operation instead of having it run by Amtrak. And the ridership is starting to climb on that service because of that. So we're seeing things change. And definitely a demand and an economic benefit for this mode of travel.
So the Minnesota plan would be a Minnesota-run, a state-run train coming into Wisconsin and back?
It would be essentially, but for something like Eau Claire, we would certainly partner with Wisconsin DOT and the state of
sure.
Wisconsin, as well as local interests.
Now, I want to talk about the momentum for all of this. And according to something that the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition put out, that national trends are starting to favor passenger rail service. So, what kind of evidence do you have on a larger scale that passenger rail is becoming cool again, I guess?
Well, we mentioned Amtrak. That's the national passenger rail system.
Ridership is up.
Ridership's up 50% over the last 10 years.
But is that in population dense? I mean, we're talking East Coast, right?
It's everywhere. And It depends what you mean by population dense. We have one of the things that we've looked at in terms of the numbers. We have the kind of corridor here on the Chicago to Twin Cities route or even between Eau Claire and the Twin Cities. Is the amount of population, distances, speed, et cetera, that can support passenger rail service. Now, you know, some corridors are very densely populated. You have three or four trains an hour. Other ones you do once an hour. Other ones you do several times a day. So each corridor is a little bit different, just like some streets have more capacity than others. But we definitely have a corridor that could support passenger rail service. And what we've seen around the country is that the ridership is there, where the services have been put on, where they're reliable, where there's a reasonable frequency of service, so it's convenient for people to use it. It has a place. Now, it doesn't mean that we're shutting down the highways or that no one will drive. It's just that this has a place, and sometimes a passenger rail trip makes more sense than flying or driving in particular situations, and it sort of fits an in-between need, particularly where there's congestion and so forth.
And I want to bring Nick Amundson into this. In terms of local momentum, two regional employers have gotten on board and are advocating for passenger rail here in western Wisconsin, Royal Credit Union being one, and Jump Software, which you're the director of research for, Nick Amundson. So why is it important to businesses like yours to get passenger rail in Eau Claire?
Well, like many organizations that are based in Eau Claire, we feel like we're just a small example of an organization that wants to have global influence. We do have offices all over the world. We have a Minneapolis office, obviously, where we do a lot of travel back and forth between the two cities. And we start looking at this from an economic standpoint, and there's a lot of funds that are being spent, not to mention time that could be spent differently in people traveling between our offices in automobiles. And, you know, we kind of look at there's an interesting paradigm as well. You talked about the millennials in your introduction, and I think there's an interesting shift in how millennials want to work. So we looked at the investment of the highways and all that in the 60s and 70s, and a lot of that was due to there's nothing else you could do during that time. But now with the shifts in technology and the shift in preferences and social media and all that stuff, millennials are looking at how could I be using this time differently? There are so many different methods of communication and forms of technology that can enable us to do things wherever we are, whether that be in a train, whether that be in a remote campsite. There's just about no limit now to what can be accomplished even outside of the walls of the office these days.
So if the train is equipped with the wireless internet, I mean, your office could be right there in that seat.
Absolutely, and we see that a lot. We have a lot of remote employees, we are taking advantage of services like the Chippewa Valley Airport service, mm-hmm. and flying out of the region for the travel that we do. But we just think that this would enable so much more productivity, as well as from an economic standpoint, a lot more benefits there as well.
So what kind of a push? I mean, how is Jamf helping with this then? I mean, just raising awareness? Are you going to kick in some cash?
Yeah, it's really early on. And at this point, it's all about raising awareness and also kind of digging more into some of the statistics, trying to find out, we know we are certainly a small portion of what's actually happening. But how many cars are actually passing back and forth across that river between here in Minneapolis every day? And, what is the desire out there? And what are the costs involved with coming up with different creative ways to accomplish this outcome?
I have a feeling that Scott Rogers and Dave Christensen might have some of those answers. But mm-hmm. Let's take our first break. We're talking about a push to bring back passenger rail service between the Twin Cities and the Chippewa Valley. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. We've got Nick Amundson of Jamf Software on the program in the studio with us. Also, Dave Christensen. He's a former rail project manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And Scott Rogers is a chair with the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition. You can ask them a direct question or offer a comment, offer a story about taking the old 400 between the Twin Cities and Chicago. 800-228-5615. We'll be back with more West Side after this.
Support for WPR comes from Festival Foods, featuring fresh flight fish. Relationships in Alaska, Boston, and Honolulu bring fresh fish direct from their docks to the store in about 36 hours. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company. Support also comes from the Water Street Historic District, an eclectic mix of locally owned shops, salons, and restaurants, many now with extended hours and events as part of the annual Water Street Holiday Celebration. Make memories on Water Street.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in on stations 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. We're talking about a big push to bring back passenger rail service between Eau Claire and the Twin Cities. There's a plan on the table. There's some momentum, growing momentum in our region. What do you think? Give us a call, 800-228-5615. Do you think it makes sense socially or economically? Would you ride it? Let us know, 800-228-5615. And if you... If you'd prefer, you can comment on our West Side Facebook page if you're feeling a little bashful. Otherwise, 800-228-5615. So, just before the break, Nick Amundson of Jam Software mentioned, more research, more study, and it's big questions like how many vehicles are coming from Minneapolis to Eau Claire, and what would travel times, there's a number of questions. So I'll go to Dave Christensen, I think, is the one, Minnesota DOT fella. How much traffic is coming through this corridor? Because it seems pretty busy when I'm on the highway. But what kind of data have you got, Dave?
Yeah, Rich, the travel corridor is pretty strong. On average, in the lowest traveled sections of the line near Baldwin, we have 25 to 40,000 passengers or travelers a day going through there. At the Hudson Bridge, we have 105,000 people crossing the bridge every day. Those are all candidates for a rail service. The rail service itself would be travel competitive. It would take about an hour and 15 minutes to make the trip from downtown Eau Claire to downtown St. Paul at about the same speeds. There'd be the intermediate stops, of course, factored in. To break even, we're looking at about 1,000 riders a day. About 5% of the travel market.
Okay.
And that has proven to be easily attainable in almost every other travel market in the country. Some places like the Northeast have over 50% of the travel.
I'm sure.
Being considered by train against flights and buses and automobiles. So 5% is eminently doable. If we can get more, we can actually, that's where we get into profitability on day-to-day operations. And four trains a day allows us to start to approach that as far as business travel as well as recreational travel.
Four trains a day. Okay, I got you. And so would there be have to be – what kind of infrastructure would have to be built? I mean, I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself here, but just for example, would there have to be a depot, built in Eau Claire or at these different stops along the way? I would assume maybe Menominee or down
the
line.
Places like Hudson, Menominee, and Eau Claire don't have depots. Currently, there's a replica of a depot in Menominee, but it's off the tracks. And so those would have to be built. The tracks themselves are in pretty good condition. It used to be a double-track main line. Now it's single. It still carries heavy freight trains, 3 to 5 trains a day.
Mm-hmm.
It has had passenger trains across it, Union Pacific business trains that were here just last year. Several of us took trips on that. And basically it can haul freight at 45 miles per hour and passenger at 60 miles per hour a day, a Class 3 track under federal nomenclature. To do true passenger travel, we'd have to increase that to a Class 4 standard, which is 79 miles per hour for passengers, 65 for freight. Just one more class improvement, which basically means that the geometry of the tracks have to be a little bit straighter, a little bit smoother,
okay.
And the roadbed has to be inspected more often. But we're almost there now.
Straighter and smoother. I mean, that sounds like you'd have to negotiate right of way. I mean, you'd have to maybe do some more negotiation.
It would be a matter
landowners?
Of contracting with the Union Pacific to improve the maintenance on that track.
Okay. But
they've already spent several million dollars in just the last 3 years putting a welded rail and rebuilding that entire line.
Right, and we'll talk about why in just a minute. First, we've got Stanley in Augusta. Stanley, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I initially heard about this show, contemplated the effect of the self-driving car on passenger rail, and so myself thought the self-driving car was going to kill passenger rail, And as I've listened, I've reevaluated and wondered if the self-driving car would actually be the thing that would make self-passenger rail work, and that you would have the availability of local transport at the terminuses, because for me, that's one of the problems. You get somewhere to an unfamiliar place, and now you're stuck with not knowing how to use local transport. And I was wondering if any work or information was available on how that's going to integrate in, if there are plans of making local transport available at the terminuses, et cetera.
Gotcha. Good questions. I'll split that into two. First, self-driving cars. Scott Rogers, this is promising technology that could make it very efficient if you have you could get work done while you're driving,
right,
commuting from Eau Claire to the Twin Cities.
Well, that really underlines the fact that travel is changing, that transportation is changing, technology is changing it. And the self-driving car, because we don't have them yet, we don't know. But I think Stanley is correct in that it's probably less likely that you'd get a self-driving car to take you to Minneapolis. But when you get to Minneapolis, you'd use a self-driving car to get somewhere.
Hmm.
We have already Uber and Lyft and some of the car sharing services in the cities that are kind of revolutionizing the taxi business. And the taxis are still in business as well. And so the other thing that is happening is cities like the Twin Cities, if you wouldn't recognize them from what they were 40 years ago in terms of the amount of public transportation is available. You have the two light rail lines that are carrying 1 million passengers a month. They are developing more of them. Union Station and St. Paul's back in place. And so these systems are getting in place, and people are using them. And so as all of them, the network expands, there get to be more and more travel options, and it's more reasonable for people. But if you think about it, one of the efficiencies of a train is if you have 300 or 400 people that can go at the same time at a higher speed than driving, then it is more convenient, it's more comfortable, use your time better. And if you look at the actual cost of moving them, it's a lot less. And that sort of leads us to where I know you had a second question, but what we're doing, we don't have all the answers yet. That's why we're doing some research. We know that there's a need for a passenger rail service. We know that above the rails, if you will, once you have the system in place, there's a reasonable chance that by instituting things like public-private partnerships, we can have fares cover the ongoing costs. But we don't know about the capital costs. If we look at other modes of transportation, the highways, for instance, you have private vehicles, you have trucking companies, you have bus lines, others who use those highways, but the public owns the highways, and there's still a public investment going on. In fact, most people probably don't realize that only about 51% of the cost of providing highways is paid out of user fees. The rest comes from other kinds of taxes, et cetera. And so our research that we're undertaking is to look at all the different new avenues and financial arrangements that are going on around the country and seeing how we might apply them here.
Nick Edmonton, you'd like to jump in?
Yeah, just wanted to comment on that. I appreciate they bring up the self-driving car because it's certainly something that I've thought a lot about as well. I think we got to look at trains and the self-driving cars, and this leading technology is complementary. I think there's still a lot of challenges to be dealt with in self-driving vehicles, both from a legislative standpoint, but also from a technology standpoint. There certainly is the Tesla out there today that has its autopilot mode, but it's not true autopilot. You still have to have a driver in the seat, and that driver still has to be paying attention to what's going on the road because it doesn't stop at stop signs or stop lights or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very interesting technology that's emerging, but you got to look at the train also as the ultimate self-driving vehicle, right? And as far as the other point I just wanted to drop in on was, what do you do when you get to Minneapolis? There's already a very substantial light rail transit system in place there, as well as the other methods that Scott alluded to with Uber and Lyft. And so there's a lot of competition and a lot of interesting evolvements in what's happening, I'd say, here with being able to get there.
I want to ask you, though, about the flip side. Someone coming from the cities, I mean, there's no light rail in Eau Claire. They got the buses, which, you know, depending on where you have to go, might take some time. Does the infrastructure, local transportation infrastructure, need to be updated, or, you know, mass transit, new options in Eau Claire?
I think it's definitely a good point to be looking at, and I think it will actually bring maybe some increased competition to our area, which would be good for all of us.
Agreed. Yeah. 800-228-5615 is the number to call. Competition's always good. Stanley and Augusta, thanks for the call. We can take your other questions and comments right now. Phone lines are wide open. What does Union Pacific have to say about all this? You know, you've got these groups that want to bring this back. Union Pacific dropped it for a good reason, because I'm sure it wasn't profitable enough for them. So what does that owner of that rail line have to say about groups like you? Scott Rogers.
All right. Well, Union Pacific is a very important economic asset to our area, and it's really important to keep them whole and to have them allow them to continue to provide the freight service they do. Mm-hmm. They move sand to North Dakota. They move grain. They move all kinds of goods in and out of our area and through our area. They have a history of working with Amtrak and with states and others where they do have the track capacity available. As Dave Christensen said, this used to be a line that had a lot more capacity and had more track. So what you have to do is work with them to make sure that they aren't disadvantaged by having passenger trains there. But there is room for that. And there are examples. They own the track between Chicago and St. Louis that's right in the middle of being upgraded right now. They have tracks in places like California that they've worked with local authorities to add the capacity needed for the passenger train service, and they've worked with those organizations. And so it's something that can definitely coexist and can actually help them provide better freight service too.
Does there need to be any additional infrastructure that Union Pacific would have to do, or that, I don't know, other partners or whatever line that would be operating this thing would have to do? I read someplace that, you know, we mentioned that there used to be two tracks, and then some of that's been ripped out. So how do you get two trains that are heading in opposite directions past each other? Dave Christensen.
Yeah, Rich, the way to integrate passenger and freight trains together is to have passing sidings out there, good signal systems. The Union Pacific is going to install positive train control, which essentially is a cell-based and satellite-based automatic dispatch system by 2018 on this line. They've already started putting in pieces of it. That is just one step away from full automation. The unions won't like to hear me say that, but but the railroads are automating as well, just like the air traffic control system and self-driving cars. And that will give them all the capacity they need. Part of the problem is, of course, the capital investment. It's a private infrastructure. So for them to put in, let's say, a two-mile-long passing siding, it's about $1 million, which would allow the passenger trains and the freights to pass each other on the roll. So nobody's disadvantaged. Not necessarily.
Okay.
They have what you call running meets, where if they're scheduled at exactly the right time, neither train stops.
Okay.
But those are the kind of things that would have to be added on the line. Not substantial improvements, but definite improvements over what we have right now.
And local governments, cities that are on the line, would they have to improve the crossings at all? Would they have to do that, or would that be the responsibility of the operator or the owner of the line?
Crossings are interesting. That's usually the local road authority that has to take care of that. If you increase the speed of the trains, you have to change the location of the sensors. You have to improve the crossing gates and the signals that are there. This line is particularly impressive because there are a lot of flyovers, overpasses already on Highway 12 and at various cities along the way. So this line was built for high-speed passenger travel. It has a lot of advantages that the other lines don't have, and they're still in place from back when the 400 was running.
Speaking of infrastructure, we already mentioned that there have been improvements. I mean, farther north, Barron to Elmina, I believe it is, a rail line that was basically a trail has been turned back into a, you know, concrete ties, really nice system. And Scott Rogers, you mentioned that this rail line has had improvements thanks to frac sand?
That has been one of the main sources, yeah. And freight rail in general, the freight railroads are carrying more freight than they ever did. So if you think rails went by the wayside and nobody uses them, there certainly are fewer miles of track and fewer branch lines. But some of the mainline railroads are moving a lot of freight now, and it's probably at, you know, sometimes there's little ups and downs each year, but as the broad trend has been, it's one of the largest. It's perhaps at the largest level it's ever been. And the other thing to think about is, because the line is already in place, because we're talking about there's cost involved, but in the scope of things, compared to having no right-of-way at all when you put in a new four-lane highway or a brand-new, eventually a high-speed rail line where you have to condemn land and take out houses and businesses. You don't have that situation here. The other thing I might mention is you don't have stations, but that's one of your opportunities, because when you get the travel going on and the traffic there and people getting off and off the trains, that's economic activity. And one of the things that as we research this further, you look at is how can the economic development that happens around the station help fund the service? And some of the things we see going on around the country in Florida, there's a rail line that a private railroad is developing, and they see the station development as one of their great economic opportunities. We also have an example, Bloomington Normal, Illinois, which is where Illinois State University is. It's on that Chicago to St. Louis line. They put in, use a number of funding sources to put in a new station there about 3 years ago, and they are saying that they've had over $200 million in private development happen around that station because they have the train stop there.
Sure, a local magnet for development. 800-228-5615. Let's take our final break here on the west side. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the challenges, some of the funding challenges for bringing passenger rail service back to an area where it's been gone for 50 years. This is the west side. We're talking about passenger rail between Eau Claire and the greater Chippewa Valley to the Twin Cities. 800-228-5615 is the number to call to share your questions or your comments. This is the west side.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're committed to our mission of informing and engaging our listeners with serious journalism and smart entertainment. Bold missions need dedicated leadership. Consider joining WPR's 9XM Leadership Circle today with your gift of $100 a month or more. To help, go to WPR.org and click donate. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin-based Country Travel Discoveries. With off-the-beaten-path tours in Florida, Cajun Country, and the Panama Canal this winter. More at countrytraveldiscoveries.com. Support also comes from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Sawyer Brown comes to the State Theater with music from their new CD, Travelin' Band, Friday, December 18th at 7:30. Details and tickets at eauclairearts.com.
I'm Rich Kramer, thanking you for listening to The West Side this Monday morning. We're talking about passenger rail and a big push to bring it back to western Wisconsin. The idea is four trips a day between the Twin Cities and the Chippewa Valley. Our guests claim that it would be competitive with driving in time. We haven't talked about cost yet, but I believe that they've got that under control, at least theoretically. But there are a lot of challenges, and we're going to talk about them right now. 800-228-5615 is the number to call in. In the studio with me, Scott Rogers. He's the chair of the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition, also works with the Eau Claire Area Chamber of Commerce. Dave Christensen is the former rail project manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, recently retired. Congratulations. And Nick Emmonson is the director of research for Jamf Software here in Eau Claire. 800-228-5615. So we talked a little bit about the infrastructure. There is still some work that needs to be done, and there still needs to be some convincing for the railroad that owns the line. And I'm just wondering about funding. I mean, how much would it cost to get four passenger trains moving between Eau Claire and the Twin Cities? And that question I'll go to Scott Rogers with.
Well, I might defer to Dave on that, but that's part of the research, is to look at what are the costs, where would the funding sources come from, how can that be matched with a public-private partnership. We're seeing that a lot in public investments now, where you leverage what public involvement might be happening. But I know Minnesota DOT has done some very preliminary look at some of the costs involved.
And Dave Christensen.
Yeah, we're looking at a cost, capital cost of starting it up of between $250 million to $400 million.
Eek.
Sounds like a lot.
That sounds like a lot.
Some of that is investment that railroads would put into the system itself for their ultimate benefit as well. Some of it would be station development. Part of it would be buying the trains. We'd have to essentially buy all new trains, but they'd have a 40-year life to them. Part of what we do in funding, obviously, is to write a mortgage on it all. stretch out the payments over time and pay it back on a reasonable basis, just like we do with our highways.
Mm-hmm.
It could be public funding. It could be private financing, which is becoming an option in just the last 10 years on a lot of these state and local operations. So it's 5 years ago, we didn't see anything happening that wasn't public funding, where you went to the state house or Congress and just asked for the money and hope you got it.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing a lot of options to that. Like Scott mentioned, Florida East Coast is a totally private operation. It's going to run true high-speed trains from Miami to Orlando, passenger trains, on several times a day. Texas, Houston, Dallas is a totally private operation. We've had proposals from private operators between Chicago and Twin Cities, but we haven't pursued them in the past. The last proposal was about 15 years ago. But because of the strong travel market, we think there's, you know, funding options. Public-private partnership, as Scott said, is truly the way to go, but that allows a lot of different options.
What would it cost the customer, I guess, can we throw a number out yet?
Yeah, we can. We have a target figure of about $33 per one-way ticket.
Mm-hmm.
That is looking at full cost recovery on about 1,200 passengers per day, which our forecast has said is a reasonable number to look at.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, has a lot of variations in it. It might not be the ultimate cost. If you can get more riders, you can lower the cost. If you want to make a profit on it, obviously, you have to get more riders and keep the cost the same.
Sure.
Shorter rides would be lower costs. And if you're going from Hudson to Twin Cities, it might only be $5 or $10.
Yeah.
If you have a family going or a group, or if you want to subscribe to monthly services like Jamf might want to do, you could get discounts for the volumes or just subscribe to seat space.
Sure.
That's being done all over the country already. And so there's a lot of options that would make it much more palatable, but that cost is reasonable. For instance, Chippewa Falls Airport to MSP right now is a $39 ride one way.
Right, with the Chippewa Valley.
That's right. Service.
Yeah. So we've got a caller, or we had a question. They weren't able to hang on the line, but these four trips a day, are we talking evenings and weekends? Because there's a lot of people that go to the Twin Cities for the arts, and would they have to drive if it's on the weekend?
We are looking at 7 days a week service, and early morning to late evening,
mm-hmm.
To be spread out during the day, so you'd have travel options. And on the shorter runs, let's say from Baldwin or Hudson into the Twin Cities, where there's a big commuter market, obviously those 100,000 people crossing the river every day are not all coming from Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming from local sources, suburbs of the Twin Cities. There could be a hybrid service with a lot of short hauls back and forth on the west end of the line, and then the all-day services reaching, of course, all the way to Eau Claire with some, if there's a commuter travel market that can be used opportunistically, you increase your service during those peak periods.
A lot to digest there. We've got a caller from Menominee. Kate, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind? Are you there, Kate? I think I lost her.
Hi.
Hi, there you are.
Yeah, this is not Kate from Menominee.
Oh, well, what's your, thanks for calling
Mary,
in.
Mary from Osceola.
Thanks for calling in, Mary. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I'm a veteran of the 400. I mean, I kind of grew up on it, going to Chicago from Eau Claire.
Hmm.
And, you know, I can remember the service. At first, it was great. You had the porters, and everybody was really, you know, lots of help and stuff. And then it seemed like at the very end, you almost had to run after the train to catch it and jump on board.
Sure.
But right now, I'm working as a volunteer. There's a passenger train. It's a local fun train in Osceola.
Hmm.
And so I've gotten to know a lot about what's going on with trains and whatever. And my question is, what is going to happen with, like when you do the Amtrak or we even do our train, the people that own the track, of course, their money is in freight. And so they have the right to say to the Amtrak or to us, you know, you have to get off the track until we get by. So how is this going to affect the train travel? You know, if you promise you're going to be in the cities within a certain amount of time, would we have the right then to do the precedent over them? Or how are they going to assure that the train's going to travel on time and get there in time?
That's a great question. Thank you for that. For example, you know, with the Empire Builder out west, there are reports that the oil trains are taking precedence, so the passengers have to wait. Dave Christensen, what about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. Historically, passenger trains always took priority over everything else on the line. In the last few years, because of congestion on the freight lines, because they have been so successful and so busy, the passenger trains, being shorter and more flexible, have been put on the sidings, and the mile-long oil trains, for instance, have been allowed to pass, partly because they didn't have the facilities in place to handle them on the sidings.
Mm-hmm.
The freight railroads disputed with Amtrak over the last few years over whether or not Amtrak had the right to require performance of them. The Supreme Court just settled that question last year and affirmed the fact that passenger trains should have priority per the 1971 Amtrak law that started Amtrak. And so passenger trains would still have priority over all of the service, and we just have to monitor that and contract with the railroads on that basis.
Can I mention something there,
please,
too,
do.
About the Union Pacific, too, and some of the railroads? Where you have done the planning and you have the capacity and you know there's going to be these several trains. The Union Pacific runs some commuter trains out of Chicago where there's dozens and dozens of trains and freight trains, and they are known for running on time. So a lot of it is, have you put the capacity in? Have you planned it well? And is the railroad worked with you from the beginning? And then you can expect a smoother operation. I think you see that with the Union Pacific, like in their California corridors and their Chicago to St. Louis corridor, that they have reasonable on time.
800-228-5615 is the number to call. If you have any last-minute questions, we can probably squeeze one more in. 800-228-5615. Do you need state approval? Governor Walker pretty famously turned down $800 million, I believe, a big chunk of change, to help establish a high-speed rail line from, at least through the Wisconsin part that would link Minnesota with Chicago. And because of that, there was a lot of hiccups along the way. So would the state of Wisconsin need to sign off on a passenger rail service in western Wisconsin? Dave Christensen.
Yeah, Rich. If there's any public money involved, obviously they would have to give approval and be part of the planning process. We would like to see that happen. The history of the Milwaukee to Madison corridor is problematic at this point. Wisconsin and Minnesota are still planning on a Second Empire Builder and eventually 110-mile-per-hour service between those cities on the Twin Cities-Chicago corridor.
Right.
So that planning is still moving forward. In the case of Eau Claire to the Twin Cities, if state money were available, it would be welcome. We see it as a public investment, but not absolutely necessary.
Scott Rogers, politically possible right now?
Well, I think the important part is we want to look forward and not backward,
mm-hmm.
and we're changing the conversation. We're looking at it for different reasons. We're looking at it for the economic driver it is, and I might actually ask Nick Amundson a question if you don't mind.
I would love that.
Because I think what we're doing is we're saying we're not just going to Madison or Washington, as I think has already been said, and say, give us some money because we want some trains. We're saying there's an economic justification here, and then we're looking at – and that's why we're still undergoing some research. We're looking at a public-private partnership that would be a different kind of proposal than perhaps was turned down in the past. And the reason I'm going to ask Nick, why is Jamf Software interested in this, and where are we going then with this project?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Scott. So from our standpoint, when we decided to get involved with the Rail Coalition, it was kind of multifaceted. So we said, well, we're definitely spending a lot of time and a lot of money on the travel between our offices, but it's also about continuing the momentum that we've got going here in Eau Claire specifically and in the Chippewa Valley. A lot of revitalization right now with the downtown area in Eau Claire. And it's about how can we continue to make this a place that people want to stop along the way and eventually, a place that maybe people from the Twin Cities want to come to for the weekend, let's say, or for a day to take in, some of the arts or take in some of the shopping, some of the benefits that we've got with this smaller city, but with places that people want to come to.
One last call. We're going to squeeze them in right now. Sydney, you're on the air. Sydney in Menominee. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was just wondering, I live in Menominee, and everybody I know is, really interested in the idea of passenger service.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I was wondering, for example, now, if we've looked into before, bus service, but you have to go, all the way downtown, to Union Depot.
Sure.
And I was wondering, would they be, adding, some more stops, on the east side of the cities? So Sure. You wouldn't necessarily have to go downtown to connect.
Very good. Good question. Now, we're short on time, so I'll go right to Dave Christensen.
That is definitely an option. The 400 in the old days had flag stops at Stillwater, Lake Elmo, on the way in. We're looking at extending service to downtown Minneapolis as well as downtown St. Paul and to the airport through either transit connections or direct service, one-seat ride. Definitely a possibility.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Sydney, and we appreciate all the calls that we got this hour. We've got about 3 minutes to wrap this up. So, Nick Amundson of Jamf Software, make the case and explain how and why you guys are going to help bring passenger rail to western Wisconsin.
Yeah, like I said, we feel like we're just getting started here, and we have a lot of work already done. We feel like the prospects for passenger rail are all present here, and we're looking for to continue to keep the momentum going, more businesses to get involved, and to keep what we've got going.
Dave Christensen, timeline here for the Minnesota plan, and would you prefer to get it going earlier?
Yeah, we definitely prefer earlier rather than later. We think we could put together an entire program if we find the business interest and funding within about 4 or 5 years. The Minnesota plan and the state Wisconsin state plans are more on a 20-year timeline, mm-hmm. and that is not something we're particularly fond of.
All right. Scott Rogers, final words.
Well, if anyone's hearing this and wants to know more, if you don't mind me putting a plug in, we do have a Facebook page. So if you look for West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition, you can follow news there. Also, westwisconsinrail.org is our website. And if anybody's interested in finding out or even coming to some of our meetings, you can find the information there.
Had some public hearings a couple months ago, or public meetings, I should say. Any coming right up?
We've had, we actually meet every month at 7:30 in the morning on the third Thursday in both River Falls and Eau Claire. So if you want to get locations and so forth, go to westwisconsinrail.org or our Facebook page, and you can find those details.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Scott Rogers is the chair of the West Central Wisconsin Rail Coalition. Dave Christensen is the former rail project manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and Nick Amundson is the director of research for Jamf Software in Eau Claire. Thank you all for the discussion. Thanks to the listeners for calling in. A lot of good questions today. That's our time. Next week, we're still working on a program, but we hope to have you join us. We'll be back in about a week, so have a safe and productive time in between. We'll chat again next Monday morning.